Today's program is brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit edwardsvaham.com.
I'm Erica Wise, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palaccio, here at Heritage Radio Network. And many of you realize, if you're listening live or within these next couple of weeks, that we are in the harvest time here for everyone's gardens who have the luxury of being able to garden, or the hard work of being able to garden. And I thought, what a better time to talk about vegetables and early American vegetables than during harvest time. And I think the harvest moon is coming up soon. I do look forward to that. My guest today knows a lot about early American cuisine, early American cooking, and particularly early American gardening. He is William Woys Weaver, an internationally known food historian and author of 16 books, I think 16 and counting, including A Quaker Woman's Cookbook and The Christmas Cook, his 300-year history of American Christmases. Well, let me go down the list here, because they are really terrific books. He's done Pennsylvania Dutch Cooking and Sours. Dr. Weaver, you can help me out here. It was Sours Herbal Cures. Thank you. It was down at the bottom of my page. Thank you. America's First Herbal. And how I first met him was, he gave a talk to the culinary historians on sauerkraut Yankees. And the book that I knew would fill the bill for today's show is Heirloom Vegetable Gardening, that he wrote a few years ago. William has been a contributor to so many articles and television shows and radio shows. He is notably the founding president of Historic Foodways Society of the Delaware Valley, and served as the associate editor and art editor of the Encyclopedia of Food and Culture. That encyclopedia received a Dartmouth Medal, which is one of the highest awards for reference books. And I could go on and on, William, but I just want to welcome you to my show, and I want to hear it straight from your mouth.
Well, thank you for having me on the air. This is a great pleasure. Well, yes, we are in the middle of harvest.
Indeed, and it's exciting, and I thank you for taking the time. And I know that it's a busy time for you, because what we will talk about later in the show is that William is very involved in heirloom seed saving, and we're going to talk about his project on heirloom seeds as we continue on the show. But you have done a lot of work, particularly on the Pennsylvania Dutch, having, I guess, living in that region, but a lot on the Pennsylvania Dutch cooking. But then that's all early American cooking. And when I forgot to mention a great book, As American as Shoe Fly Pie. I think that was your most recent book, right?
That is indeed in
yeah.
print.
And that's on Pennsylvania Dutch cuisine. What I thought was very interesting about the early American cooking is that so many people are not aware that vegetables were very much a part of the colonial and early American food scene, if you will, on their plates and in their gardens. I think a lot of people have this vision of kind of our more rustic, you know, meat and roasts, and maybe just a bunch of squashes. I guess we're thinking, you know, Thanksgiving myth celebrations, but not so. And I know that Thomas Jefferson's gardens at Monticello just had a big celebration, big anniversary. But tell us a little bit about early American gardens.
Well, I would say that there is a great deal of regional identity. In other words, the New England kitchen garden was very different from the southern, very different from the middle state. So there was an enormous amount of biodiversity based on climate and soil. Also, you have to look at the finances of the particular person or family in the colonial period. Someone like Thomas Jefferson was very wealthy, and his kitchen garden was not only intended to feed a large number of people because he had a huge amount of staff in his house, but also it was a status thing among the well-to-do to have beautiful vegetables. And so there was a lot of, you might say, social peer pressure on the well-to-do in, throughout the colonial era to grow vegetables and have fine kitchen gardens. In the Victorian period, this is replaced with flowers.
Well, and you only have to look.
Eat, but they're beautiful.
Right. Well, you look to Colonial Williamsburg, and they sort of had to revive their gardens from, you know, from that shift as well. And
right, right. So we're looking at the early American culture through several layers, from particularly the Victorian period, which more or less, with colonial revival, sort of rewrote the history of our early foods through very rose-colored glasses, if you will. Even poor people, though, ate a lot of different kinds of foods. I would say if they didn't have large kitchen gardens, they certainly ate a lot of foraged foods. And by that, I mean they went in to the woods and into the roadsides and what have you and collected greens. And so they supplemented their diet with wonderful wild plants that are very nutrient, you know, concentrated nutrient value in that. So that's one of the points that I brought out in my book, As American as Shoe Fly Pie, because even the buckwheat Dutch, as we called them, the poor Dutch who lived in the hills and ate buckwheat bread, because buckwheat only grew on bad ground, even they ate rather interesting things that we no longer eat today, like chinkapins, wild chestnuts. They're, in fact, coming in right now in Pennsylvania, and I have a big box of them in my kitchen. So there was a good biodiversity there in dietary choice. We've lost that. Today we have, what, five or six commercial apples in the stores. I mean, our whole diet has been focused down onto these very limited selection of commercially raised foods, and I would like to talk about that, the nutritional value of that food.
Absolutely.
At some point,
yeah.
Because we really know a lot more right now about what's going on nutritionally, something called the dilution effect. In other words, since 1950 to 2000, there's been a huge decline in the food value, the nutritional value of our food. And if you go back to the colonial period and you start raising those heirlooms organically, the way, well, there was only organic agriculture in those days, the food is better for you.
Mm-hmm. Just looking at that some of the early cookbooks, like Amelia Simmons or Mary Randolph, you see so many recipes for salads galore, made with all kinds of things. And then when you mentioned that they went and foraged, that was something I was curious about, how much of the vegetables were wild versus cultivated.
We don't really know, because we don't have diaries to tell us, well, we went out in the fields and collected dandelion, that kind of thing, mm-hmm. although we have some of that information.
Mm-hmm.
Probably it varied from family to family. For sure, before the Industrial Revolution, before the 1850s, even well-to-do people were not at all embarrassed to go out in the fields and collect wild sorrel and that kind of thing and incorporate that into their diets. It was just, it's what you did. And as we became urbanized, there were these social stigmas against eating poverty foods like that. We wanted to eat white bread, meat, you know, that kind of thing. And that really changed American attitudes towards wild harvest foods. But now look what's happened. That is all back.
That movement is back in force. Yeah. You know, it's interesting because when you said in the Heirloom Vegetable Gardening book, you yourself wrote that when you began to write about gardening, that for me, what you did is you dispelled for me, and I'm sure many other readers, a very prominent century-old myth that persists today, and that is that since the coming of the industrialization, that we've looked to the Mediterranean for a return to the birthplace of real food, and so that's really why I wanted to talk about, especially with you, you know, where the real food was even before then.
Well, it was all over the place. It wasn't just in the Mediterranean. I think the Mediterranean myth has sort of taken over. Everything today is now Tuscan.
Right.
I mean, Tuscan fish recipes when they don't eat fish in Tuscany, that kind of thing, you know. But look, there's a huge movement of back to the woods, even in Scandinavia, and there are a lot of famous restaurants now in Sweden and Denmark, and they're eating their own regional foods, and these were there all the while. We've just forgotten that we used to eat these foods, too. Perhaps in the Mediterranean area, people, the villagers were not as well off, so they kept to some of the older practices, and we've looked at that area as sort of a model. But, you know, I'm doing work on the foods of medieval Cyprus, and that takes me into a whole new another planet in terms of diet, and they were not using olive oil. They were using the fat of fat-tailed sheep as their basic cooking fat.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, people were more active years ago. The houses weren't heated, so we burned our calories differently. And some of these historical diets are very interesting to study because, in terms of their period, they were really very healthy. Because they fulfilled certain nutritional needs. We have to realize that eating heirloom breeds of sheep or whatever, we may have to adjust the way we consume this because of the way we live today. But just the same, I think chefs all over the world are beginning to realize that in terms of flavor, in terms of visual preparation, the heirloom breeds of animals and vegetables are really where it's happening at the moment. The downside, I would say, is that it's not trickling down to the bottom level of society where there is a real nutritional problem in our inner cities, and those people are not getting this. It's being, you know, showcased in high-end restaurants. But this will change. I think we'll see some very good changes over the next 20 years in that.
Right. Well, you know, urban provisioning has been an issue that it's a whole other show, and that is a problem indeed, as you mentioned. Yes, but I mean the diversity of vegetables in the 1600s through the end of the even 1700s, I'm amazed when I read some of the recipes and the accountings of the types of vegetables. But in those types of vegetables that we read about, have they changed over the years, you know, with hybridization and things? In other words, are we still eating the same celery now or tomatoes now that we ate, that they ate 3 centuries ago?
Well, it is possible to eat the tomatoes from the 1500s if you want to, because the genetic material still exists. I have ancient Mexican tomatoes in my own seed collection. However, let's take the tomato as an example, because this is sort of an icon vegetable in the United States. Tomatoes changed. During the Victorian period, the breeders created round, smooth, red tomatoes. This became sort of the ideal, a tomato that looks like a Christmas tree bulb. The old ones didn't look like that. They were ruffled, or they had lots of different odd shapes to them. Sometimes they were hollow. But they took the red currant tomatoes and crossed them with the large red ruffled ones, and they got these round, smooth. So over time, the physical appearance of the plants or the fruits, if you will, the tomato in this case, changed because we imposed new criteria on them. The canners, in New Jersey, the canning industry wanted these beautiful red round tomatoes. This was good for their 19th century profits. Beets have changed. They used to be carrot shaped. We bred them to be round. In fact, now we've got these flat beets that grow on top of the soil with very small roots. They were developed to be raised on table height beds inside of greenhouses, so that the super rich in Europe in the 19th century would have these beautiful, picture perfect vegetables all year round. So I would say all of the basic vegetables that we know of have been tinkered with in some way or another. But I still have medieval cabbage, for example, which is open-headed. It looks like a great big green carnation because all the leaves are, spread apart. It doesn't fold together to form a head. That's something we've taught cabbage to do.
Right.
So when we're raising heirlooms, we've got two things going in the garden. We're trying to keep the plant stock alive, but we're also constantly correcting the plants to keep them growing true to their old standard, because plants want to revert to their wild state. And I have the Roughwood Seed Collection, and this is one of the big tasks we've got right now, because we're harvesting seed, which we will be selling through Baker Creek Heirloom Seed Company this fall and Hudson Valley Seed Library. And we want our seed to grow true and to look like the heirlooms that really very some very famous ones, which we're going to be releasing this fall.
It's a lot of work. Yeah, it is. And I actually want to get to that work, because I want to hear about the seed collection and the heirloom seeds, talk more in detail about that. But let's take a short break so we can really get into the heirloom seed talk, okay? So stay tuned.
If I had a magic wand, tomorrow everyone in the world would have enough food to eat that was culturally appropriate and delicious. The planet would be thriving because all the food would have been grown and produced in a way that sustains us, both our bodies and our world. But man, I do not have a magic wand. What I do have is you and this radio station, the Heritage Radio Network. That's what we're here to do. We're here to help lead the way to a future that's more delicious, that's more fun, where we're healthier, where the planet's healthier, and we want you to be a part of that. We can't do it without you. As a nonprofit radio station, we depend on the support of our listeners. So take a minute out of your day, visit the website, and click the big beating donate tab. Throw us a few bucks. Every bit helps. We're counting on you.
The following program was brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit edwardsvaham.com.
Hi, we're back on A Taste of the Past, and I'm talking with William Wise Weaver about early American vegetables and heirloom vegetables. I want to mention our break music. You heard the lovely and haunting voice of Odetta Hartman. I want to make sure that I mentioned that. Dr. Weaver is also, I read all kinds of wonderful projects that he's involved in and books that he's written. But something now that leads into this discussion is he is on the board. He's a board member of the GMO Free Pennsylvania, and not the GMO, it's GMO Free Pennsylvania, and the Experimental Farm Network, which is a grassroots organization devoted to alternative methods of seed production. And William, that I think is a great way to start this discussion. You have, as you mentioned, the Roughwood Seed Collection. Now, this is a project that was started by your grandfather, correct?
That's right. He began gathering seeds in about 1932, primarily because he was working on our family history. We're from Lancaster County, and he was connecting with cousins and relatives out there, and it was the Depression, and he wanted to grow food for his family, so that was the basic reason it started, but then it grew and grew and grew, and then I've added to it over the years.
Well, it's interesting because there are a couple of Seed Saver projects around. The Seed Savers Exchange, of course, is the one that many of us know about, and they're now trying to keep these seeds in, you know, in safe locations all over. Tell me about when you get what you assume to be an heirloom variety, take me through the process a little bit.
Well, for example, my grandfather was a friend of Horace Pippin, who was an African-American artist. Mr. Pippin would visit my grandfather to get stung by bees because Mr. Pippin had a bad arm, and this bee sting would help his arthritic condition. So he would give my grandfather peppers. And peppers of really very beautiful colors, because Pippin had an artistic eye. So we've got the Pippin peppers, and they've got Mr. Pippin's story attached to them. Where he got them, I don't know. This was before my time. So I have an interest in African and African-American heirloom plants, and I've been gathering what I can of that. I was also involved with Native American peoples. I was on the Indian Committee at Philadelphia Yearly Meeting. That's a Quaker organization. And through that, I inherited quite a large collection of very, very rare endangered Native American corns and squash, some of which came from Gladys Tantaquidgeon, who lived in Connecticut. She was a Mohican, did a book on Delaware Indian folk healing. And Gladys gave me sweet corn, and now I think I'm the only person who's got it. It's Delaware blue sweet corn. We've now got hummingbird, which is a speckled sweet corn, masked dance, which is a purple sweet corn. We've got the white wolf, which is a white sweet corn, cindamokin, which is blue, sandhill, which is gray, mother turtle, which is variegated. So right there, we've got five or six varieties of sweet corn that you've never, ever seen in a market. And they are absolutely incredible eating. And we're just now growing these out in isolation, first so they don't get polluted with GMO pollen,
right.
Secondly, so that we can take these up to commercial scale, either sell the seed or sell the corn, because I'm not collecting genetic material for the Roughwood Seed Collection to make a seed library, you know, like a collection of Egyptian artifacts. This is about food waiting to happen, food that's got to go back into the system and be part of our culture. This food was eaten in colonial times, and it was long forgotten, but a few people were growing it out in the 19th century and the early 20th. And fortunately, it's not extinct, but I've become something of a Noah's Ark, which worries me greatly, because at age 68, I have to think about what's going to happen to all of this down the road. But the basic thing is that each one of these heirloom plants that comes into the collection, I try to get documentation, I try to get the stories, because this is part of the cultural heritage of the American people, and it belongs to all of us.
Right. Well, and you wrote that the collection of the Roughwood Seed Collection comprises about 4,000 varieties.
About 4,500. We keep adding things to it, and we just received a lot of seeds from Africa, and we were growing them this year. So if they do well in our climate and they have good food potential, we add them to the collection. Mm-hmm. I have a Roughwood seed collection manager, and that's Owen Taylor. Owen is here today in the garden doing all kinds of jobs. But so I'm not doing this single-handedly. Owen brings in volunteers, and since we're going to be operating as a 501c3 nonprofit under the Experimental Farm Network, we're going to be able to get donations. We already have been using the people that come here and donate their time. We've been giving them workshops free, training in seed collecting, roguing. That means taking off plants, pulling them out, and keeping the varieties pure and, you know, growing to specification. So this is an art that has been lost, and it's very important that people learn this, how to do this, because if they're going to be growing their own food, they will want to be in control of their own seeds.
All right. Well, and it's interesting because one doesn't think about, well, prior to in the colonial times, where did they get their seeds, whatever they brought with them from wherever? Because there were no seed catalogs prior to 1796, I think, was the first seed catalog, right?
The 1790s, we start getting seed catalogs. But before that, there were lists of seeds published in newspapers. So they more or less acted like catalogs. What happened in the colonial period is that most of the seed stock was coming from Europe, either England or Holland or Germany. The Mennonites in Pennsylvania were connected to the Mennonites in Holland, and so there were a lot of Dutch seeds sent mm-hmm. over in the colonial period. We didn't have people in the colonial period. We didn't have a lot of people who were trained in plant breeding and seed saving. So we had to rely on European seed crops like turnips, cabbage, all of that was being done in Europe. By degrees, however, American plantsmen began to breed their own because, first of all, a lot of the European varieties weren't well adapted to our climate. You know very well, with cucumbers, in England you have to grow them in cold frames. It's too hot in our summer now for many of the old varieties. So all of these adjustments had to be made here in the United States. And then we really did take over the seed breeding business. And I would say it was focused in Philadelphia. There were maybe 10 or 15 internationally known seed companies in Philadelphia right down into the 1920s. And all that breeding was being done right here. Up in Bucks County, first of all, and then it moved to California because they had a much easier, a longer growing period out there. But so the seed saving and the seed breeding end of the story is something that has very interesting. It's gone through a series of stages here in the country.
Right. But I know there are some people who in rural areas of particularly Vermont and upstate New York, I'm talking only about the East Coast that I know of, that do have always saved their seeds, whether they be particularly beans and different varieties of tomatoes and squash. And it was sort of like the Grange, every community had a Grange or something, and there would be time when they could exchange seeds. And
right.
And never did we realize how important that would be.
Well, this is true. I would also have to add that in Pennsylvania, we're actually a very large state with five different culinary regions, and it's a lot more complicated than the outside world imagines. But we have these wonderful hidden valleys up in central Pennsylvania where families have been there for hundreds of years, and they're still growing some of these Native American squash that I thought were extinct, and I've been collecting them over the past five or six years, and it's amazing what's still out there. So it's not all grim.
Yeah.
It's just a matter of making the right connections, and I think with PASA, that's the Pennsylvania Association for Sustainable Agriculture, and sister organizations like that in other parts of the country. I think the awareness of our food riches is growing. This is a very good thing because if you go to Europe, they think that all we eat are hamburgers at a McDonald's. And, you know, frankly, I've never eaten at a McDonald's, but I have my own food agendas, but that's another story. Just the same, I think it comes as a huge surprise to people outside the United States that we have this incredible culinary heritage, and it's based on these wonderful food plants and these historic vegetables that we've been growing for centuries.
Well, we certainly here at Heritage Radio Network are trying to spread the word and educate people as to some of the wonderful projects that are going on now and things that went on in the past. You mentioned something early at the top of the show that I wanted to touch on before we run out of time, and that is you talked about the dilution of nutritional value in right. some of the vegetables. Just give me a brief background on that and what happened and why.
Yeah, well, it's called the dilution effect, and we actually have now nutritional data to prove that this has happened. Since hybridization started in the 1950s, the food value has declined in commercially raised foods. By commercially raised, I mean these big agri-farms. Agribusiness is growing, you know, thousands of acres of tomatoes
right.
and shipping them from all over the country. The decline is anywhere from 20 to 30%, depending on what you're measuring. When you talk about the nutritional value of food, there are vitamins, there are minerals, there are all lots of different things that come into play, and it varies from type of plant to type of plant. But the bottom line is that we're eating a lot of food with empty food value, and so we're having our brains are telling us we've got to eat more in order to satisfy our, you know, the little bells that go off in our body that say you're not getting enough of this, you're not getting enough of that. We did at Drexel University when I was teaching there, we did an experiment with tomatoes, and we had a pound of heirloom tomatoes raised organically, the same food value you would get from a pound and a half of commercial hybrid tomatoes.
Hmm.
So in other words, you have to eat more of those hybrids in order to get the same food value as you would from an heirloom raised organically. And that's because the organic method of agriculture is drawing up trace minerals and nutrients from the soil, which the hybrids are not because they're being fertilized with chemicals. They're just pulling up the chemicals from the ground. The plants are not drawing out of the ground the same kind of material that the organic plants do. So it's complicated. But the sad thing is you go to the supermarket, you're buying food that's been shipped in from somewhere else, and it really doesn't have – it's empty food. It's as bad as junk food.
Mm. Well, hopefully one day we can bring all this great produce to everyone and have more green markets everywhere. And,
right. Well, New York's got wonderful green markets.
We do. We do.
It's out there.
But bring it into the grocery, you know, bring it into the big supermarkets where, right. you know, people are able, people who live in what we now call food deserts, if you will, I mean, that just have, you know, access to very poor nutritive valued foods that we can bring this into the supermarkets and there they would just be able to walk in and get it. But
well,
that I have, and that's another story too. And there's some fault in urban planning. You know that you go up to some of these old original colony towns in Virginia or whatever, and they were planned. You know, with plots set aside for the gardens with the houses.
Exactly.
And, all right, and what happened? You know, we just let's put up another skyscraper and another parking lot.
Well, we try at the Roughwood Seed Collection to spread the goodness around because if we have extra seedlings or extra seed, we don't throw them away or compost them. We send them into Philadelphia so that the inner city community gardens can benefit from them. So at least it's going to be food for somebody.
Right.
That's great. One of the things we've been doing.
Okay, one last question because I know we've gone over and there's just so much interesting information. My last question to you is, how you mentioned 15 Mexican tomato seeds from the 1500s. Are those the oldest seeds in your collection?
No. I think the oldest pure variety is a melon from Cyprus, a Copnu melon. It's depicted in Roman mosaics.
Mm.
So we've got a melon that's growing that's several thousand years old, and it hasn't changed. You eat this melon as though it's a cucumber.
Wow, that's fabulous. That is, I'd love to plant all those seeds in my backyard, if I had a backyard. that would be terrific. I look forward to hearing more from you, and I can't wait for the foods of medieval Cyprus. Wow.
That's going to be an interesting one.
Yeah, yeah.
Volume one is done.
you are a terrific resource for us, and I thank you so much for sharing your time and all your information. And hopefully you will inspire others to do the same. And that the Keystone, the Keystone Farm
Keystone
Project?
Center, yeah.
Keystone Center.
Right. Where we have a board meeting coming up, and you're going to hear more about Keystone because we're revising our website, and we're going to do a conference on sustainability.
It's a Keystone Center for the Study of Regional Foods and Food Tourism. So
right.
that will help spread the word as well. And I encourage people to continue listening to our show and many shows on the Heritage Radio Network, because we do try to incorporate so many of these wonderful programs and talk about ways of saving our food. Well, William, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I would like to thank my engineer, Liz Smith, of course. And you have been listening to A Taste of the Past, and I'm your host, Linda Palacio. And up next, you're going to hear a short clip from one of our shows called Foment About It.
Carbonation, oftentimes, it's the most forgotten about ingredient in beer. You know, it really determines your perception of dryness and can change your texture and flavor of your beer greatly.
On episode 126 of Foment About It, Ben Granger gives valuable advice on how to get the desired amount of carbonation in a brew to prevent your final product from falling flat.
Now that brewing and brewing culture has grown to a point that people are like really, really aware of that, and especially, you know, professional brewers are aware of that, it's very important, or a good idea anyways, to bottle any of your beer that you're bottling off of a keg, not bottle condition, but bottling off a keg, via counter pressure. And what it basically does is, when you transfer from the keg to the bottle is pressurized so that as it fills, there's no oxygen in the bottle, and the CO2, your desired level of CO2 that you put in there on purpose, stays in saturation. That way, when you know, if you're at, I don't know, a brewery and you get a counter pressure bottle fill on a growler, that way, when you open it at home, it's exactly as the brewer intended you to consume it, which was the whole reason why I did it in the first place.
For the rest of Ben's interview, check out the rest of episode 126 of Foment About It. And if you're interested in mastering the art of home brewing, you can listen to all episodes of Foment About It on heritageradionetwork.org and iTunes. Heritage Radio Network is a member-supported nonprofit organization broadcasting over 30 live shows a week. To learn more and donate, visit our website or connect with us on iTunes, Stitcher, Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, and Instagram for more. Thanks for listening.